Hi, folks. I think we're ready to get started. We are really honored to have Bill here tonight. He's incredibly successful. He's sold over 10 million books of the Ben Kincaid series. There were so many honors listed when I went on Wikipedia. I thought, I'm not even going to talk about that because everybody can see them. I mean, just and across many genres, including poetry, which was pretty impressive to me. But what I really got from all the reading I did about you, besides the Ben Kincaid series and all the different books you've written, was that you and Laura are really giving back to the writerly community, and that you've opened up the Red Sneaker Writer Center, and you offer wisdom and boosting of writers from all over on it, and it's a free newsletter, and that you have two publishing businesses, including the, what is the one that is more literary? Oh, I did. No, I got more, the more I got into it, the more kind of intimidated, and then I just realized, when I realized how much you're giving to writers, it was like, oh, this is wonderful. So we're very honored to have you. And I think that's about it. Just this list of all the books. Yeah, so thanks for coming very much.
Annie, may Thank I you. Be really rude?
Yes. Yes. No, please do. Hey, we're very loose here, so we like... Yeah,
so
it's really a privilege.
Being that it is available and Annie knows how folks can reach me.
Yes. Thanks, Cassie. And the one last thing I have to say.
Okay. I'm going to go back to sit over there.
Yeah, no, because I'm almost done. This was the other thing that really impressed me and that I came away thinking, this man loves words. He writes crossword puzzles for the New York Times in his spare time, so... I'll do one of them.
Okay.
Oh, and you do them in under 10 minutes or something?
No, solve them. Maybe
oh, my
Monday.
Gosh. In ink?
Is this
yeah, Monday, me too. I can do that one.
Can I just sit here? Is that too lazy?
No.
No, that's just fine.
My mother would be so appalled. You can't do public course. As soon as she saw I was wearing sneakers, she'd be appalled. So I'd already be out of there. Wow, this is. I get to sit while I talk. This is the best. Well, thanks for having me out. This seems like a really, really wonderful center. What do you call this? Writer's center? Yeah. What a nice resource for all the writers in the company. That's really nice. And of course, got to thank Cassie, who's the reason Laura and I are out here this week. She was the one who opened our home so I could manage to put this together. And let me tell you, there couldn't be a better host in the whole world. And as I was telling... Someone, Annie, I don't remember somebody a couple of minutes ago, if you can go out in their backyard, go out near the water and not be inspired, then just forget it. It's never going to happen for you if it doesn't happen there. Okay, so I'll talk a little bit and jabber, and I'm going to read some poems and whatnot. But when we're done with all that, you know, I'm supposed to ask for questions. So you guys be thinking of some good ones, so it won't be all, oh, who's going to go first and whatnot. And try and come up with some stumpers. Keep me on my toes, okay? None of this, where do you get your ideas or whatever. I'm telling you already. What?
The idea book.
Yeah. I usually alternate between From My Head or... or maybe Poughkeepsie. There's a subscription service or something. I'm just kidding. Anyway, very nice to be here. As Annie was saying, I am kind of a words geek. I don't make any bones about it. I always have been. As far as poetry goes, my mother, who's turning 90 in a couple months, likes to tell people that I was writing poetry and telling people I wanted to be a writer when I was 7, which really I thought was kind of dubious. And sure enough, not too long ago, she opened this big box and pulled out some church bulletins on which indeed I had written poetry on the, I assume I was really bored or something, but I wrote poems on the back of the, I mean, they're horrible, but they are technically poems. They have 4 lines and they semi-rhyme and the bulletins are dated. And sure enough, I would have been 7. So just never argue with your mother. She's always right. I was very fortunate to fall in love with books and words and stories at an early age. Taking your minds back for a little bit, I'm in a small town in Oklahoma, long ways from here. Skinny, underweight kid, horrible at sports, have both a stammer and a speech impediment, big, thick Coke bottle bottom glasses, massive social anxieties, school not really my favorite thing, raced out of school every day. This was in the days when, you know, we walked to school and back, even though it was a pretty good distance, but the way it's laid out, let me explain the neighborhood, because we lived on this street called Country Club Circle, which is really misleading because there's no country club or anything like a country club. There was on the far end a public swimming pool, which I assume is where the street got its name, but tucked away kind of behind the swimming pool was the Midwest City Municipal Library, which was about the size of the room we're in right now, maybe slightly smaller, in fact, but about that. But they had a lot of books, and I came racing in many a times a week, because here's the school and here's home, and the library wasn't quite on the way, but pretty close. And there were some wonderful librarians there who took a real interest in this scrawny, geeky kid who kept coming in every day and would encourage me and point things out. And what I remember best is one in particular saying, you know, don't just read this all the time. You should read this and this and read, come on, we can move to some more grown-up books and read broadly, which is a habit that has stuck with me all my life, both reading and writing. Many times people have said to me, you know, you'd probably, you know, the big names, the best-selling names, are people who become known for doing one thing, and they do that one thing kind of over and over again. And as Annie mentioned, I've done 19 of those Ben Kincaid books, but I've been, okay, now I have to do math, 46 minus 19, what does that leave? 27 other kind of books, poetry and children's books, and a young adult, and a couple of historical novels, and been very fortunate to be able to do a lot of different things. But you know what? It all goes back to that library. And one librarian, wonderful woman in particular, who sadly we lost about a year ago. But you know what? She's going to live forever up there. Okay. I should have gotten this out before. But here are my copious notes for my presentation. Here is the first poem in my first book of poetry, which is called The White Bird, and it's called Scratches. I think you'll be able to follow this and see where I'm coming from. This is how it begins. Scratches on signs, on blocks, on a white page. Then the scratches start to dance. They recombinate. They collect sounds. They call your name. Like so much in childhood, they are ciphers full of secrets. But once you learn the dance, the mysteries of the world and more are revealed. You learn to read. You learn manners from Goldilocks, curiosity from George, gluttony from Peter, nonsense from Alice. You set sail with Jim Hawkins, raft with Huck, and row with Mole. Love is eternal, Catherine tells you. But so is madness, warns the first Mrs. Rochester. Jeeves helps you laugh. Poetry helps you cry. Atticus shows you how to do both with courage. Not only have the scratches shaped the world, they have shaped your world. They have taught you how to see. Now you need never be afraid. Now you will never be alone. In the darkest night, in the deepest solitude, the scratches will call to you. You will open the covers. They will reach out their arms and say, "You thought you were the only one? You're not." So I started writing. Wrote my first novel in the sixth grade. Still got it. It's horrible. It's not like anybody was going to publish it. It's atrocious, but by gosh, I wrote it in pencils. Cassie and I are both lovers of fine pencils. And kept writing all throughout and sent them out, because if you wanted to be a writer, you had to send things out to get published, right? Got my first rejection letter when I was 11. Still got that, too. Got a bunch more, like hundreds thereafter. Kept sending things out, but people kept turning it down, and for a reason. It was awful. But over time, I was slowly but surely kind of teaching myself how to write. Of course, finally went to college, English major, predictably enough. But strangely enough, I was reaching the end of my undergraduate years and hadn't published that big, national bestseller yet. So I started thinking, I may need to do something else here in the interim, which is what led me to law school, of course. Thinking, there's this, and here's the real appeal of law school. I thought, what do lawyers do? You read, you write, you don't get sweaty, and you don't have to understand math. This is the thing for me. And so I ended up doing that. What I never anticipated, of course, was that this would not just be an occupation or preoccupation, but that I would end up using this over and over again once I started writing books. Ben Kincaid, as she may or may not have mentioned, is a lawyer, young lawyer at the beginning of the series, and picks up steam with time. Anyway, I know there are some people who have a certain cynicism about lawyers, not in Gloucester, I'm sure, but perhaps elsewhere in the world. I got to tell you, when I was going to school, so many of the kids that I ran with anyway were keenly idealistic. They were in law school, then they were going to save the world, they're going to save the trees, do public interest law, whatever. And then, of course, that transition from law school to real world is often kind of treacherous and challenging and dispiriting for some people. And my mom always said, well, you should write what you know, which is a problem when you're 26 and think, what do I know? Nothing. But I thought, okay, this law school, law world, big law firm, that's something maybe I could write about. And that was the genesis of the Ben Kincaid character, who in that first book, Primary Justice, has just gotten out of school, gone to Tulsa and joined this big law firm. I don't know where I got the idea for this book. It just seemed like maybe something I could write about. And pretty soon, after a period of about 2 years, I had a book. And about 2.5 years later, I had an agent. Pretty soon, it was published. And the book, this first book was a hit, and I've been going ever since. I am supremely lucky, I realize, because if you accept, as I do, that this is what I've wanted to do since I was 7, and certainly I've done other things, but, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I'm living the dream. I know there are people who are more prominent and wealthy or whatever, but I'm getting to do exactly what I always wanted to do. I get to do it every day, and we can still kind of sort of get our kids through college, so how perfect is that? I think it's the dream deal. Took me a while to get to poetry, though, because in my mind, that's the pinnacle, you know? Faulkner said something much the same, except he did it in reverse order, but, you know, he started writing a book of poetry and thought that was a flop, and then he tried a play, and that was a flop, and then he resigned himself to writing novels for the rest of his short stories. I kind of, you know, not that novels are easy. Are they easy? Cassie? Laura, who's written several books herself? No, they're not easy. But then, moving up the pinnacle to me, poetry, that's the hard stuff. Of course, I was always reading and writing poetry, but it took me a while to kind of build up the courage, you know, to actually publish it. I was writing in a sequel, and finally, after about 20 years of writing, I started quietly sending it off to journals and whatnot and getting some of it published until finally, maybe 6 or 7 years ago, I decided to try for a book, and that's when The White Bird was published. I was concerned because so many of the poems that I had written were so personal, you know? I mean, that's what poetry, I think, is almost inherently self-revelatory. Can you guys hear me okay? If anybody's having trouble hearing, you wave at me, okay, and I'll crank it up. But a lot of them seemed really personal. I thought, who's going to be interested in reading about my kids or my cats? But you know what? When the book was published, those are the poems everybody liked best. Forget all the, you know, profound, mysterious, nobody knows what the heck you're talking about kind of poems, but the one where people could at least get inside the door and relate to it, that's what people responded to most. I realized going into this that I had a problem because we have several children. So I tried to make sure each of the kids had a poem in the book. And then the book is published, and my youngest, Ralph, comes up and says, "Dad, I've got a problem with this poetry book of yours." And I said, "Ralph, there's a poem in there for everyone." And he said, "Yeah, and there's 3 for your cats." Well, yeah, but I mean, they're cats, come on. So after that lead-in, I'm going to give you, of course, a kid poem and then a cat poem. So here we go. Also from The White Bird, the first one, this is called William Harrison. He's my oldest. He's in China now teaching, but obviously when this poem is written, he was much younger. "I am nothing like you," reminding me of the many times I thought exactly the same about my own father. "Don't use that voice. I hate that voice." Reminding me of all the nights I cradled him, whispering Annabel Lee and Hamlet's soliloquy until he fell asleep. "You're ruining my life," reminding me of our countless hikes through that undeveloped lot, he wearing a safari hat and me pretending my nose was a compass. I feel like I'm going to explode, and I would recall how he would jump on my back unexpectedly and hug tight till he was practically a part of me and I a part of him. "I must go to the mall." And I take him. But what he will never know is that as we prepare to cross the street, I reach for his hand and have to stop myself. And now, as promised, the cat poem. Percy. Percy was a great, you'll get this from the description, but he was a great cat. When I would work, when I'd type, he would lie across my wrists, which, anyway, that's what I'm describing here. Percy. He shivered in my arms as he died, just as he shivered when I found him, abandoned in a field, his whiskers and body seared by cigarettes, infested with fleas. I took him home and held him all night long. Eventually, he told me his name was Percival, but I could call him Percy. Many people passed through that house, but he said he would always be my cat, and I did not doubt him. Long hours I spent typing, his body spread across my wrists, his head bobbing with each keystroke. It didn't look comfortable, but he didn't seem to mind. The shivering ceased as he did, and I whispered that he had been a very good cat, and I would not forget him, and I am embarrassed to say that I was slow getting him to the vet because I could not see to drive. Okay, less emotional stuff now. Let's talk about something else. We've been talking this week about poetry. I've written poetry, obviously. My wife Laura writes beautiful poetry. Jason's writing poetry. We've got poets all around us. And I think there's this myth kind of going around that poetry is dying out, nobody reads poetry anymore, blah, blah, blah. Nothing could be further than the truth. In fact, there are a lot of signs that poetry is having a major resurgence right now. I don't know if anybody else has seen this, but the NEA, the National Endowment for the Arts, has recently released statistics that show that not only is poetry reading increasing at a pretty sharp percentage, like more than 10%, but the age group, the demographic in which poetry reading is increasing the most is with young people. It's the 18 to 30 demographic that, you know, you thought they were tweeting when they were staring at their phone all day long, but they might have actually been reading poetry, because as it turns out, all this social media stuff that you may love or hate is a good breeding ground for poetry. We now have what they call Insta-poets, because they're finding their audience and promoting their poetry on Instagram, which requires a visual. You know, you got to take pictures or draw something or some way make it sort of visually interesting. But this has turned out to be a great incubator for the modern generation of poets, some of whom are very good. You know, we can't turn up our nose and say that's not real poetry. Real poetry is in the English department or whatever, because it's not always true. Who in this room? Okay, it's Final Jeopardy time, Cassie. Nobody in my seminar can play. Who knows what the best-selling book of last year, of 2017, was? Anybody? What book sold the most copies?
Billy Collins?
What?
Something of Billy Collins?
That's a good guess, because he is probably the best-known modern poet. But no, it's a book called The Sun and Her Flowers by a young poet named Rupi Kaur, K-A-U-R, if you want to go look her up. And she built up her following on Instagram and built up, you know, this is smart, one might say, that first she had her following and then her first book was published. Milk and Honey did very well. And then her next book is published and it's the best-selling. I knew something was going on because I travel a fair amount and I would see this book in the airport, you know, where it's mostly just thrillers and books that have the secret to giving you a happy life. Just like that, and whatnot. And I thought, poetry? What, have I entered an alternate universe or something? That's how popular this book is. This book has sold over 300,000 copies. By comparison, the poet who won the National Book Award last year sold about 20,000 copies, which is a darn good number in the world of poetry. But there are people, there are others, Tyler Knott Gregson, who I think my wife is a fan of, and others, flourishing on Instagram. Or we have YouTube poetry. How many of you have watched or seen a slam poetry presentation? There's one. What'd you think of it? Did you like it? That's a no, right? What? Did it seem like that? That's what my kids say when they don't want to tell me that it stinks or something. It was interesting, Dad. Did it seem like poetry to you?
Sure.
Good. I mean, to me, slam is kind of poetry plus presentation, you know? It's got a performance art thing. Sometimes at your university poetry readings, people affect kind of a neutral, unemotional tone because they, I don't do that, obviously. I don't know how, but you want the poem to speak for itself. I get that, but not with the slam poets. There, it's all out there, all the angst and drama, and but that brings it to life. It makes it interesting for people in the audience in a way, you know, it's just one more way to respond to poetry. Anyway, there's a lot of that going on. There are whole YouTube channels, like Button Poetry, that are devoted toward that kind of slam poetry. Hip-hop, rap, is that poetry? It's got meter, it's got rhyme. In many cases, at least, it doesn't have melody, so I'm not sure why we're calling them songs, but they are definitely poetry, it seems. They've already heard this story, but this is true. Several years back, I was at this dinner with, among other people, Seamus Heaney, the Irish poet, who at the time, he's passed sadly since, but at the time was pretty much considered the world's greatest poet. So I'm sitting here at the table, sort of kind of just working up my nerve to speak, you know, and come on, Bill, you'd be so sorry if you leave this and you don't say anything to the guy. So, and I'm thinking, you know, when I want to settle down and read something really good, something I know is going to be good, I read him. Who's he read? So I asked, finally, Mr. Heaney, what contemporary poets do you like? And without even missing a beat, he said, oh, I quite like that young lad, Eminem. He took rap seriously. So at that point, I thought, well, I guess I've got two. Cassie's been to see Hamilton, I know. Did you like it?
I loved it.
It's mostly words.
And you were big on it.
I kept wanting, I'm old school, I wanted them to sing a Rodgers and Hammerstein number, like Oklahoma. And there's none of that in, but the words fly and the excitement in the theater was terrific. It seems to me that's very close to spoken word. I mean, at some point you have to ask yourself, which is more popular, modern poetry or rap? It is just possible. I mean, we sort of set aside for a while meter, strict adherence to reader, and strict adherence to rhyme schemes in favor of free verse and blank verse and modern poetry, and I get that. There's a lot of value in that freedom of expression, but I wonder sometimes if we've lost something that really appeals to people, something about rhyme and rhythm makes it easier to remember. Rhyme sort of gives your words an extra punch. I don't know. Maybe.
But Phil, you know, one
yes.
of the things, excuse me for this, mm-hmm. I'm assuming you're comfortable with interacting with rather than...
Would it stop you if I said I wasn't?
I know you well enough to yell stop.
Come on.
But I also know you're not uncomfortable. Back to the Hamilton thing, one of the pieces that you and I have talked about a little bit is taking a subject matter that could be really yawning, really like,
true.
Oh my
American
gosh,
history.
Who is going to want to spend millions of dollars on Broadway to talk about, you know, the early part of the development of our nation? And so I think one of the things you do, and we can talk about this, take this further, is how do you make language transform the ideas and the situation so that it becomes incredibly engaging?
Mm-hmm.
And I think, even though you and I tease each other about Hamilton, whether it's rap or it's hip hop or whatever, you know, okay, so getting past that, the point is, it's successful. You don't like it, and I do like it, but fine.
Well, it's
the
cool.
The point is, it's really successful, and it is yawning material.
Mm-hmm. Well, except not when they do it, not with the rhythm and the rhyme and the hunky actors.
But that's the point I'm making. It becomes magical because of language and
yes.
because of the transformation. But if we just talk about history, and I hand you a civics book, you're going to be asleep in 20 minutes.
I think you're right.
I read the novel and I was fascinated. So.
Have you seen?
Well, Tom, you are who you are.
I think what she's saying, though, is that the kids who were in the balcony when I was there, squealing and screaming before the show had even began, wouldn't have picked up, although they might now after they've seen the musical, but they wouldn't otherwise have.
Exactly.
He's made it cool. All right, another poem for you. We need to lighten things up, so I've got a chipper poem with the title Hell. Dante left a lot out when he described the nine circles of hell. Somewhere in the third lies a vast shopping mall, jam-packed with bargain hunters demanding the latest iteration of stuff they already have, carrying Sisyphean shopping lists. Each time you find the last Talking Elmo Cabbage Patch Disco Dino Ducky, three more items appear on your list. The fifth circle of hell is one big cocktail party. You are forced to make small talk. As your tongue swells, your teeth rot, and your face suggests a gangrenous zombie. Where do you get your ideas? You can supply your own answer. The seventh circle of hell is a children's ward. Tiny bodies with IV tubes and oxygen masks. And far too many faces you recognize. In the ninth circle of hell, the pit of the abyss, is an empty room that looks just like our living room, our kitchen, our bedroom. But you are nowhere to be found. Who's been to Oklahoma? Show of hands. Shall we sing? Speaking of musicals from dubious material, that musical, of course, was based on a play by Lynn Riggs called Green Grow the Lilacs, which is a strange little play and got much more serious issues and racism and homophobia and stuff that didn't make it into the Rodgers and Hammerstein version. Sometime you want a lesson in translation, go compare the two. I was going to talk just a minute about another poet, somewhat more famous from Oklahoma, talking about Woody Guthrie, poet and songwriter, Oklahoma's, really, America's troubadour. I always hear people talking about how you can't sing our national anthem. We need a new one. Make it America the Beautiful. And I always think, no, make it This Land is Your Land. That's the one that, well, it's an Oklahoma boy for one thing, and for another, it's the message that I think we all need to hear. This is your land. And some of the lyrics, some of the verses people rarely sing are really pretty, pretty telling. Guthrie has a checkered history in Oklahoma because, of course, people think of him as being this kind of radical socialist labor union organizer, and Oklahoma being a very red state. Sometimes people aren't sure how exactly to treat him these days. Here's a poem he wrote in 1948. A lot of the experts say it's basically his last great poem or song lyric, but what are song lyrics except poems that once again have meter, have rhyme? They have to because they're song lyrics. How many of you knew, more trivia time, that at some point later in his life, Woody Guthrie moved to New York and he lived in this kind of a tenement apartment building owned by... No, I didn't make this up. Fred Trump, who, yes, indeed, is the father of the current president of the United States. Woody did not care for him very much, among other reasons, because it was a racially segregated apartment complex. People of color were not welcome, and he wrote letters and poems about, I won't say what he called him, but about that guy Trump. We have a museum now in Tulsa, the Woody Guthrie Museum. It's a beautiful modern facility, and they've got the letter and the the manuscripts right there on display. It's pretty cool. Anyway, he wrote this poem in 1948, and I won't go into all the details, but it's inspired by a true incident. What had happened then is now. There is a major government crackdown because people were all up in arms about Mexican illegal immigrants, farm laborers, migrant workers, which, you know, were at least in some quarters welcome when there was work to do and not in the off season. Anyway, the tragedy that sparked this song lyric occurred in 1948. There was a plane, 32 people, 28 of them migrant farm workers, being shipped back to Mexico, and it crashed in Los Gatos County. Everybody died. What really offended Woody Guthrie even more than the tragedy of the whole situation was the fact that in every piece of newspaper coverage, one after another, they never identified the names of the victims, as you would normally expect. They were just referred to as deportees. Hence the name of the song and the poem. I'm going to read it, if it's okay, is Deportee. The crops are all in and the peaches are rotting. The oranges piled up in their creosote dumps. You're flying them back to the Mexican border to spend all their money to wade back again. Goodbye to my Juan, goodbye Rosalita. Adios, mi amigos, Jesus, y Maria. You won't have a name when you ride the big airplane. All they will call you will be deportees. Some of us are illegal and others not wanted. Our work contract's up and we have to move on. 600 miles to that Mexican border. They chase us like outlaws, like rustlers, like thieves. The sky plane caught fire over Los Gatos Canyon. A fireball of lightning shook all our hills. Who are all these friends who are scattered like dried leaves? The radio said they were just deportees. Goodbye to my Juan, goodbye Rosalita. Adios, mi amigos, Jesus, y Maria. You won't have a name when you ride the big airplane. All they will call you will be deportees. All right, I think it's time for some questions. Throw them at me. Who's got a question? Stump the band. What do you think? You'll shut me down if I've gone too long, right, Annie? Yes.
Do you feel like you write your work, or does it write itself and you just hear it and then write it down?
Oh, I feel like I write my work. It's hard work. I don't know who, my characters just come alive and take over. I mean, give me a break. I understand.